This is Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Now be quiet and listen. A revolt is brewing.
Why don't we go ahead and just clear up some of the confusion now that no one is listening?
What you're hearing right now is a secret recording of a CIA agent named Sharon.
I have participated in covert operations that would stretch just...
We're in the shed in the backyard of a house in Los Feliz. And Sharon's trying to enlist a group of CIA recruits into a plot to turn whistleblower and expose the agency's involvement in some African coups, you know, typical CIA stuff.
And that is why I need your help. I believe that if we work together tonight, we can develop...
Now, the audio isn't great because the recorder is hidden.
Is,
I mean, not because we're worried about the CIA or anything. This isn't the real CIA. It's theater. Sharon is an actor, and we're trying not to ruin the make-believe for everybody else.
5 years ago, I invited you to join the CIA, and tonight we're going to burn it to the ground. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, then let's get to work.
This is immersive theater. It's an experience that involves the audience in the story. The show is called Safe House 82. It's a spy thriller. Well, not so much Tom Cruise. Immersive theater tends to be more intimate. Yeah, that's better. Safe House 82 is part of a whole constellation of interactive experiences designed to pull you out of your regular life. It used to be fringy, it used to be avant-garde, but now there are escape rooms in cities all across the country. There's virtual reality in the mall, and there's a little company building a whole alien world in Anaheim. On today's Greater LA, our mission, and by the way, we have chosen to accept it, is to uncover how immersive experience is growing, what it has to do with Disneyland, and how it's hacking our brains to make us put down our phones and, you know, connect with one another. For that, we go to our agent in the field, reporter Brandon R. Reynolds.
Usually when you dress for a night at the theater, you don't feel compelled to wear an old Hawaiian shirt and grow a mustache. But immersive theater asks you to go that extra mile, and so I do. This is Safe House 82, the spy thriller taking place on a dark side street in Los Feliz. There's a party going on. The year is 1982. There are about a dozen of us, some audience, some actors, all spies. We're playing games and having drinks and eating some Chex Mix in the living room of a house that's disturbingly beige, in a way that only the late Carter and maybe the early Reagan eras really could be. There's a jangling rotary phone and bad art on the walls. Old Playboy magazines are fanned tastefully on the coffee table, but it's not that kind of party.
My name is Jen Kaleidis Meslow.
Jen is here with her husband, Scott. They're veterans of the immersive scene.
A dinner party with all of LA's most infamous serial killers and victims. So got to chat with Charles Manson for a while and had, it was like a 5-course meal, figuring out kind of what happened to, it was a missing person.
I got buried alive in a casket, which I thought would really only be for like 30 seconds, but I was in there for about 5 minutes.
Right. So Jen is basically very, very down for this particular night of theater. She likes it. It makes her feel more present.
Normally when I go into a room, I just see a room. I don't think, oh, that's really interesting. I wonder what that poster signifies. And it makes you kind of pick out details that in your normal day-to-day life you wouldn't think about.
So, listen, I'm sorry to cut you short, but I've just found out.
Soon, a character pulls us aside and asks us to do strange things with fondue. And suddenly the story's in motion, and we're in the middle of it. As with many office jobs, you realize your boss is running guns into Angola.
Of course she is.
Later, there's a corkboard with photos and names and maps connecting it all. And there's a real Betamax here in the wild.
When you bring people into an immersive show, you're asking them to step into a different world and accept that this is a different world for at least this, you know, hour or two. And I think that it's a lot easier to do that and more fun to do that if you're also pulling people into a different time period.
That's Nick Reinwald Jones, who, with his partner Caitlin Schiller, created Safe House 82 and 3 other shows.
You know, you cross the threshold and now you're 40 years in the past. And it feels almost kind of safe from the outside world.
Nick came to LA to try his hand at screenwriting.
And I just started writing scripts and pilots. And I had the sort of standard amount of non-success where I, you know, had a few meetings, did well in competitions, had some people like what I was writing, but never far enough to actually get anywhere.
He'd seen an immersive show in New York that really affected him. He wanted to write one. Meanwhile, he and his wife bought this house in Los Feliz and decorated it in a 70s style to rent out as a themed Airbnb. This is the second production they've staged here. And when the show closes, the house will go back to being just another 70s themed Airbnb.
A lot of it was based on the restrictions of what can you do inside of a house. You can't have a car chase. You can't have explosions, at least not yet. What seemed to make sense was having a spy thriller disguised as a house party.
The show is kind of a Chex mix of cultural influences. Video games, plays, theme parks, and a nostalgic kick of old TV shows. This is art that owes everything to other types of art, but doesn't feel like any of them. And it's not passive.
That's one thing that immersive can do that definitely separates it from any other kind of entertainment, that there's the sense of being paid attention to, which I think, you know, is a really valuable and important thing right now, because, you know, so much of what we experience in entertainment now is, you know, constant stimulation, but of the variety that it's not personal to you. A billion people are watching what you're watching. You can sort of zone out while you're doing it. And this is something that both acknowledges you as a person and demands your full attention.
Now, what you're paying attention to has evolved over time, and so is the intended emotional response. Here's a quick and dirty history. It all started with haunted houses, or haunts in the trade. You pay some business to abuse your amygdala. That's the part of the brain responsible for fear. That's the job.
Why is this more extreme, more intense, more frightening than any other haunted house?
It's more in your face. The actress can touch you. You can get wet. You can get electrocuted. There's bugs. So there's lots of crazy stuff.
Now, if you want more out of your experience than electrocution and bugs.
Back to you guys. This is not cool. This is not cool.
Let me be the first to suggest escape rooms. These are now in most major cities. You know them. You're locked in a room where you solve puzzles and crack codes in order to solve the alchemist's riddle or get out of jail or something. Escape rooms borrow heavily from film tropes. And because we're trapped in this great big escape room called culture, film tropes also borrowed from escape rooms.
I think this is the escape room.
We should look for clues.
What are we looking for here?
Anything that looks like a puzzle.
This movie is called Escape Room. Los Angeles is ground zero for the immersive boom.
We have this incredible amount of venues and talent and creators on every angle, whether you're looking for programmers, if you're going more technical, to directors and performers, improv comedians, everyone you need to be part of an immersive experience.
This is Tommy Haunton, a designer of interactive experiences. He says there are 140 escape room companies in Southern California. That's not rooms, that's companies. The variety of immersive experiences available here is, in a word, bananas. There are large-scale shows that involve stunt work and soundtracks, and there are tiny shows like Red Flags, which is just a bad date, you and the actor. Really. And then there's a show called The Nest. It's for an audience of one or two people. You explore the storage unit of a woman who has died. The Nest is amazing. It's surreal, it's heartbreaking, it's beautiful. It's a way of inhabiting art. Of transforming space into something that evokes wonder.
For a moment, I felt like myself. Like I was whole again. And then I woke up.
What draws us to this? Here's Tommy again.
You know, we subsisted as nomadic tribes, hunting mammoths and building villages and wandering and hunting and gathering. The connections we crave are ones in which we sit across from people we care about, and we go on adventures and do tasks that help us survive. We don't really do that anymore. And immersive interactive entertainment allows you to sort of go on these adventures together with people you care about, or hell, even strangers.
Now, as far as I know, there's not a mammoth hunting immersive out there. But the La Brea Tar Pits experience hasn't been updated since the Pleistocene, so... That's a good idea. You laugh, but there's money in it. Disney knows.
Star Wars Galaxy's Edge is the most immersive themed land that Walt Disney Imagineering has ever built. I'm lucky.
Over the summer, Star Wars Galaxy's Edge opened at Disneyland and Disney World. It's a whole planet where you dodge stormtroopers, explore spaceships, and shop intergalactic.
I'm so excited.
Visitors don't ride roller coasters. The ride is, you know, being an alien on an alien world.
Thank you so much, everyone. I wouldn't have been able to do this without all of you, and I appreciate that you put your lives on the line.
Back at the safe house, nearing the end of our two-hour show, Jen and the rest of us are rushing around like our parents are going to be home soon. Jen is really good. She's basically like a professional spy. I ask her if she's got advice for first-timers.
You might feel uncomfortable at first, but ultimately you'll walk away having an experience that is a lot different from, you know, a normal Friday night, whether you're staying in and watching a movie on Netflix or you're going out to dinner with friends or going to a bar or something. It's something that is going to challenge you, and even if you don't like it, it'll make you think.
And it's that kind of thoughtfulness that helped us finally expose the CIA's wrongdoing. Safe House 82 has a few possible endings, and we experienced the best one. But even if we hadn't, we all spent a beautiful night in a long-ago era that was both politically and fashionably ugly. So that's something. This is Brandon R. Reynolds, reporting from Los Feliz, 1982.
Wait, where am I? Oh, back in the studio. Wow. All right, coming up. Water, water everywhere, and way too much trash as well. Capturing all that trash and crap before it gets to the beach and ocean is proving more difficult than some water managers imagined. A new report outlines how they're doing. You're listening to Greater LA, You Think, on KCRW.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you're a surfer or swimmer, this you know for sure. When it rains, you stay out of the ocean. Now, winter rains are great for helping end fire season and building up drinking water supplies. It's all good. But here in Greater LA, a big storm also means millions of gallons of storm water draining straight out onto the beaches and into the ocean. And that stormwater carries with it a lot of filth and garbage on the streets and in the drains. Bacteria, oil, grease, chemicals of all kinds, just a bunch of debris and garbage. It all goes into the ocean. Watershed management groups are supposed to capture and clean that stormwater. But a new report by the environmental nonprofit Heal the Bay finds that they're only treating a small fraction of the water that they're supposed to. Annalisa Moe is water quality scientist at Heal the Bay, the author of the report. Annalisa, thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I want to talk more about how stormwater is actually captured and treated. So how does this process work?
So there's many different ways that you can capture stormwater, but the general idea is that you put in a project that is able to retain stormwater in some way, so either allowing it to infiltrate naturally or capturing it in an underground cistern or something like that, putting it through a treatment process to skim out the trash and potentially also take out some of the other harder contaminants like copper or zinc, bacteria, things that are invisible to the naked eye, and then either releasing it back into the waterways or reusing it on site. You can use it to irrigate lands or you can replenish our groundwater reservoirs with that water as well. So there's many different ways that you can
It's not potable, right? But it is, you can use it for the other stuff.
Yes. And once it's treated and then once it infiltrates through the ground, it does get cleaned up enough to replenish our groundwater. And then that is a safe source of water.
So not quite a Brita filter, right?
Not quite. But a similar similar process.
I want to talk about the results in your report. Watershed management groups are responsible for capturing, as you mentioned, and treating this stormwater. There are a dozen of those groups. Give us a quick snapshot of what you found and how they're doing.
So what we found so far is that we are not on track to reach goals. Each of these watershed management groups has a different deadline to reach these goals because they are based on federally mandated water quality objectives. And
these are EPA standards.
EPA standards, yeah. Thank you, yes. And so some of these deadlines are right around the corner. They're coming up in 2021. Other groups have a little bit longer. They have until 2037, I think, is the latest deadline. None of the deadlines have officially passed yet, but we should be working towards them. And at this point, we don't see the type of implementation that we need to be seeing to reach those goals on time.
But how are they doing, like, as far as capturing this stuff?
Yeah, so our assessment is based on information that was in the annual report, which is available to any member of the public. And what we found is that collectively we're about 10% of the way there. And again, because some of these deadlines are in 2021, right around the corner, we do need to be implementing a little bit faster than that.
When I'm walking down the street and I see the storm drain and it says, go straight to the ocean, you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
The little sign?
Absolutely.
Right? Is that true? Straight
yes.
there?
It does go straight to the ocean. So in Los Angeles, we actually have a separate storm sewer system that is separate from our wastewater sewage system. Other parts of the country have a combined sewer system. San Francisco, as an example, has a combined sewer system. And that actually causes some problems sometimes because when you have a very large storm, it can overflow their sewage system and cause sewage spills. So we don't have that problem here, which is actually a pretty good thing. But the problem is that while the wastewater is sent to treatment facilities and is treated before it is discharged, the stormwater goes directly into storm drains, which lead to the Los Angeles River or Biona Creek, which leads directly to the ocean.
You mentioned Biona Creek. I want to talk mm-hmm. about this this group called the Biona Creek Watershed Management Group. Your report found that this management group captures just under 75 acre feet of stormwater for treatment, but the intended target is more than 2,000 acre feet within just the next year or so, year and a half. Is that typical of how far behind these watershed management groups are?
From what we found in the annual reports, it is pretty typical. Part of the reason for that is that the management groups did have to come up with a plan first before they started implementing. And so there was a little bit of delay in that implementation. And now that we have plans in place, we have Measure W and we have potentially a strong MS4 permit in 2020, we're really expecting to see that implementation ramp up in the next 5 to 10 years.
So do you take 2,000 and then subtract 75 from it, and then that's how much stormwater makes it into the ocean and onto the beaches?
Roughly, yes.
I want to talk about a big change that's about to arrive on the scene. This is Measure W, the Safe Clean Water Program. LA County voters passed it last year. It goes into effect in 2020. It's projected to provide millions of dollars, $300 million, I think, a year. At least some of that money will go toward the capture and treatment of stormwater. Is that a game changer, do you think, going forward in fixing this issue?
Absolutely. I think we have a really great opportunity in 2020 to change the way that we've been approaching this permit. And Measure W is going to be a huge part of that. It will be roughly $300 million per year, which is actually going to double the amount spent by permittees on stormwater capture projects. So it definitely is going to be a game changer. And these are projects that are specifically targeting capturing, cleaning, and reusing stormwater.
This is, as I mentioned, the first time that you guys have really looked at this, have studied and reported on stormwater. With this new money, are you going to do this every year?
We're hoping to, yeah. And actually, part of our report is pointing out the fact that the data is very complicated to dig through. And so this is our first attempt at doing an assessment of how we are managing our water in Los Angeles County. But we certainly want to continue to work with permittees to update this every year to really show how much progress is being done on a yearly basis.
Annalisa Moe, water quality scientist at Heal the Bay. You can read her report, by the way, at healthebay.org. Annalisa, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, from the vast Pacific Ocean to a concrete water basin in the now Tony neighborhood of Silver Lake. It used to serve as a reservoir for drinking water. Now the Silver Lake Reservoir functions as a dam with a running trail around it, a lawn, and a dog park. But there are bigger plans apparently in store. The reservoir may be turned into a destination with far more amenities for runners and kids, even nature lovers, but not everyone's happy about it. Frances Anderton hosts KCRW's Design and Architecture. She's been following this debate. Hello, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
Talk a little bit about this. Why is Silver Lake considering plans to change, or I guess update the reservoir now? Because people love to hang out around there.
Yes, despite the chain link fence that surrounds
that
the
surrounds
entire
it,
vast
right.
area, which is somewhat off-putting. But yes, as you mentioned, you can jog there. There is a lawn. There's a dog park. Folks in the neighborhood got those things added over the years. But what's going on now is since the reservoir was drained 5 years ago, there's been much debate about the reservoir's future. And right now it is in the midst of a design process. The city enlisted a landscape designer, a well-known firm firm called Hargreaves Associates. And they have been involved in a very extensive public outreach process. Now, those can be really great, but they can also surface, let's just say, different perspectives on what people might desire in their neighbourhood. They've had a lot of public meetings. They wound up presenting three different design options. There was a survey. It was responded to by almost 3,000 people. There's very strong feelings about what to do with the reservoir. And let's just say there's been some divides over what amount of change to bring to the reservoir.
You said that there were three different plans, three ideas, right? Talk us through those.
That's right. And they're called Option A, Island Overlooks. Option B, Active Edges. Option C, Blended Spaces. Essentially, Option A kind of does the least. It sort of retains the concrete bathtub, provides some overlooks on the water, but doesn't change too much. The second one, Option B, is much more active, recreational space. There's suggestions of boating, swimming, the creation of more wildlife habitat, a whole combination of amenities, educational areas for learning about climate change. So a lot in that plan. Then there's option C, which would blend elements of both option A and B. Ultimately, the majority of those almost 3,000 people that responded to this survey wanted a combination of option A and B. They wanted greater access and amenities. They wanted greater beautification. They wanted greater protection of existing wildlife with more wildlife habitat integrated into the scheme.
Well, and if they want to see something, you know, a change in a water feature, they just need go like, what, a mile down the road to Echo Park Lake, right?
Interesting that you bring up Echo Park Lake, which I think many would consider is a great success. I mean, it's gorgeous, Echo Park Lake.
It wasn't always that way.
Correct. And it's had a big makeover. And the reservoir may be going down that path and really becoming a more bucolic, sort of pastoral feeling, an attractive place to be. What appears to have transpired in Silver Lake is that there are folks there who actually are slightly worried that the reservoir would become too much like, too attractive, like Echo Park. There has been pushback from those who would rather see not much done at all to the reservoir. They argue that this is because they're very concerned for wildlife and they don't want to see too much sort of human impact on the park. And they also don't want to see much commercial impact on the park. This is represented most loudly by a group called the Silver Lake Wildlife Sanctuary. What one hears from opponents of that group is those concerns about wildlife and preservation are really masking a more sort of insidious nimbyism, a desire to sort of keep people out, to keep access to parking around the edge. So this has created some, let's just say, tensions in the neighbourhood. Then there's lots of people who live in the neighbourhood who responded to the survey who don't have a vested interest in any particular one of the options, but are really kind of excited that something's actually coming to the reservoir. And one of those people is Alison Pugash. She actually herself works in environmental planning and policy. She lives in Silver Lake. She's not attached to any group. And this is what she had to say.
At the end of the day, they're going to be adding shade and improving the dog park and creating new access to the waterfront. And those are all fantastic things. So I don't think it requires all this hotbed of controversy.
But there is controversy because, as you mentioned, there's a bit of nimbyism there. People don't want all those. And it's understandable. You don't want like a tourist attraction right across the street from your home.
That's certainly what some would argue. On the other hand, some will say, how great that this bleak view of this bowl of water surrounded by chain link fence is going to become a destination. I will say that you could look at this in two different ways. One other Silver Lake resident that I spoke to joked that this whole process has been an example of, quote, entitled people screaming. On the other hand, you could say it's really fantastic that so many people come out to get engaged with an open design process and are so invested in turning, you know, what was a bit of an eyesore into a beautiful place to be.
Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's DNA. Frances, as always, thank you.
You're very welcome, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, it's the R word. for the L word, as in the reboot of a Showtime classic that dives into the lives of lesbians in Los Angeles. Next on KCRW, it's All the President's Lawyers with Josh Barrow and Ken White. We are online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. I consider it a personal honor for you to subscribe to our podcast. You can ask questions at kcrw.com/askgreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Taw, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl make this show happen every day. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great day.